And we're back. It's the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. And we're going to be talking shortly with Dr. Theogen Rudasingwa, author of the book Healing a Nation, a Testimony. And we're going to take some testimonies, they say. I know we have listeners from East Africa. I met recently with some people from Eritrea and learned a lot about the country. And we've had guests on from there and from of course, Tanzania and elsewhere. And we also have people who are concerned about U.S. policies towards Cuba. Dr. Rudasingwa, as a representative of his government, had dealings with both these phenomena. He was in Eritrea, Ethiopia, as he said, a peacemaker. That's in his book. That's why I recommend that people get it. And, of course, he also he met with Fidel Castro, who was a childhood hero of his, who was a great thrill. And along the way, he learned a lot about how the world works. And I think we're joined now by Dr. Theogen Rudasingwa. You there, sir?
I'm there. How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. It's nice to talk to you. You've got a great book here, Healing a Nation, a Testimony, and it's called Waging and Winning: A Peaceful Revolution to Unite and Heal a Broken Rwanda, which you've taken on a big job, and I congratulate you.
Yes, thank you very much. It's a big job, but it's a worthwhile one.
I think you're very well qualified. I want to make sure we get into, I want to get to the main substance of your book, but I want to tell people that in many ways, it's an autobiography, it's a memoir. And your political career is, of course, something we want to trace. However, we'd be very remiss if we don't say something about your mother, both at the beginning of your book and at the end. She is so crucial. You were born in a refugee camp in Uganda. Certainly, you were in a refugee camp in Uganda. You lost your father when you were quite young and did not know him. And you came from a fairly good-sized family. Your survival and your future were in the hands of your mother. You want to tell us something about her?
Yes. Thank you so much, Phil. Indeed, the book is mostly a personal story or a family story, but it's a story that is also intertwined with a country's story. And not surprisingly, indeed, the book begins with my mother and somewhat ends with my mother. Mm-hmm. But the larger part of the story is really to show, even by recounting how I became a refugee at a fairly young age, probably 1 year old, that the problem of being a refugee has almost become part and parcel of Rwanda's story since the first revolution, 1959.
Mm-hmm.
And it's more than 50 years later. So it has become a very, very enduring problem. Mm-hmm. And by recounting my story and the story of my mother and recounting how we were refugees in the past and we were refugees again, and my mother is probably 86.
She's still with us
again. So I try to show that yes, this is a human story, but a story that somehow shows the challenges that modern Rwanda faces.
Yeah. Well, by the way, you close the book. You have Mama's 11 survival lessons, and they are excellent. And I just read. She says, "Whatever you do, number one, do not give up, even as a refugee. Two, rely on humanitarian relief for the shortest possible time and be self-reliant. While in exile, settle down and stop being a nomad." She wanted you to get to school, and you and your brother, I find it really remarkable that and your sisters, that you got educations, and sometimes she was very wise in moving you from, for example, she had been a Catholic, but then she became Anglican. you changed churches, but the main thing was you got to get to school.
Yes, yes. It simply shows you that what I also try to show in the book and highlight is essentially the wisdom and the forcefulness and the farsightedness of African women in particular, but women in general. I think each one of us who has been able to live and be of any use to oneself, to family, mm-hmm. community, and nations or internationally, has gone through the hands of some woman somewhere, whether yes. it is our mothers or our spouses. I think it simply shows the resilience of African women mm-hmm. In trying to look after their own children, to look after their families, to be the center of communities and be able to find direction for their own. So
yes.
I think reading that story, one gets a clear picture of how important our mothers and yes. the African women are.
Well, and one last small thing on that. I myself worked in Tanzania, and I met many Rwandans, and I just wonder, I found I could generalize that wherever I met Rwandans, whether we were talking about Hutu, Tutsi, or Twa, they were very education-oriented. Every Rwandan I knew was always studying.
Yes, yes.
So there's some cultural trait there to be hung on to.
Yes, yes. Because I remember my mother used to tell us that the only thing that was between us and living a life of poverty forever and ever was the education, and that we had not inherited any wealth. We did not have anything. We were absolutely poor. You remember I described in the book how, we... simply survived by, in the beginning, trying to go and work for food from the local population. Mm-hmm. And my mother, being the wise woman that she was, decided that we should cultivate our own food. She insisted that we should be vaccinated or immunized. And
yes, that's one among her 11 things to do is get yes. vaccinated.
Yes, and so she realized that education was really a game changer, and I'm glad that she was insistent on that, because it simply has made a lot of difference in my life.
Mm-hmm. It certainly was. Now, we're speaking to Dr. Teogen Rudisingwa. He's the author of Heeding a Nation, A Testimony. I do hope people will get this book, because as opposed to what often happens in this book, this really is important testimony. As a matter of fact, it's vital testimony. If we're going to understand what happened in Rwanda, I'd say the modern period here between 1990 and today, Dr. Rudisingwa was an executive member of the Rwanda Patriotic Front. He was the Rwandan ambassador to the United Nations. He was the in charge of the president's office in Kigali for a long period. And therefore, has an intimate knowledge of all the experience of the Rwandan Patriotic Front and those tremendous years. And let's begin, if I could, where I pick up your story. You decided to take up arms practically on the day that the whole fighting began, and your leader was not Paul Kagame. Your leader was Fred Rugema.
Yes, and certainly, as I described in the book, the fact that the leader was Fred Rugema made my decision to join the Revolutionary War much, much easier. I sometimes, in retrospect, wonder if it had been Paul Kagame, whether I would have made a similar risky decision to join the revolutionary organization. But Fred Rugema was a guy who was renowned for being a people's soldier, somebody who was magnanimous, somebody who would build consensus, and who was renowned for having been a successful soldier at a very young age. And so I asked very quickly in my mind that if General Fred Rugema was leading the effort, then I'm safe, and the vision it should be okay, and I should be part of it. So it was those kind of snap decisions that you make in life. Sometimes you make them on the basis of a very quick understanding of who is going to be your partner in that kind of undertaking. So, yes, General Rugema leading the effort made my choice very easy.
Yes, and but you know, you've had some so quickly you're seeing changes, because of course within days you lose the leader Fred Wagema. He was killed either the first or second day of fighting at the border of Rwanda Uganda, which and by the way, you point out that was a basically a failure. I mean, you had to go through a whole change of orientation following that, because it wasn't only Fred Wagema that you lost. You lost another commander, I believe. And so there was a the story is often told here is people think it was just one long line of victories. Actually, the first one was a setback, right?
Yeah, it was absolutely a military setback. And as you might recall, by the end of October 1990, indeed, the top leadership, military leadership, had been killed. And by the end of December in 1990, essentially, RPF and RPF, RPA had been driven out of, entirely out of the territory of Rwanda. And that's why even the government of Rwanda at that time celebrated. I would have said it was a premature celebration. Mm-hmm. But essentially, by the end of December 1990, RPF had been driven out of the territory of Rwanda. Mm-hmm. And it was in a terrible, terrible situation, mass desertion. The condition of the soldiers was really mm-hmm. terrible. We lost so many people, not out of combat, but more out of the general poor conditions that prevailed at the same time. Mm-hmm. And so it took quite some time to reorganize. And mm-hmm. what I also describe as one of the most unfortunate accidents of history is for Kagame to have risen, actually to become the leader of the RPF and the RPA, because while yes. indeed he led it to the victory of 1994, which is a victory that should be qualified further. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it created the conditions for dictatorship, which the people mm-hmm. of Rwanda are suffering from right now.
You know, by the way, you provide very, very detailed treatment and some nice portraits of many of the individuals involved, like President Museveni of Uganda, and you mentioned other figures who had come from, had been trained in Dar es Salaam. And these were young progressive men in terms of ideology. You yourself had read Franz Fanon and Che Guevara, et cetera.
And Walter Rodney. How
yeah, Walter Africa. Rodney. I'm sorry. Yes. The key guy, I guess, would be Walter Rodney, right?
Yes. Yeah,
now, but when you do say that, I never see you make any reference to that being part of Kagame's makeup.
No, I actually do not know much about what has inspired him or what was the formative stages of Kagame. But I will tell you that certainly Kagame is not an inspiring character. If you are looking for inspiration, you certainly do not go to Kagame. He instills fear. He controls the situations, and
he seems to be a military. And he uses, even in his last conversations to you, as described in the book, he is using military references.
Yes,
I have to tell you, I'm familiar with them, having been in the military. And then he wants you to be a soldier.
Yes, and
which basically that means take orders, doesn't it?
Yes, and so I think he was he certainly is a disciplinarian, and he was able to effectively use that at a time when the RPF, RPA were disorganized, the disorganizations after the initial setbacks. But here is the dilemma: the kind of disciplinarian and controlling top command kind of character that is necessary in a liberation movement during the struggle like that one, mm-hmm. Those types of qualities are not necessarily the kind of qualities that are relevant or useful in building consensus and building a country that suffered so much from the genocide, the war crimes, and all these problems since mm-hmm. from 1994 onward. Mm-hmm. And so that's probably one of the most unfortunate things that have happened, that Kagame should have risen to become the leader of Rwanda at a time when Rwanda actually required and needed somebody who would be able to lead the country in a post-traumatic period.
Yes, but
Uganda, particularly Museveni and his young brother, were very instrumental in putting Kagame there at the top of the RPF.
Yes. By the way, I mean, one of the things you call for in the book, and thank goodness you wrote it, Healing a Nation, this is Dr. Teagen Rudasingwa, is that we have to be honest or candid about what people were doing and what their real motives were. Now, actually, I lived through the period where there was total denial, and if I read the Toronto Star, I would read that the government of Uganda claimed not to have any knowledge of what the RPF was doing and had no responsibility. But I've, of course, on this program, I've talked to UN personnel and others, and they said, well, of course, they were deeply involved. I don't know, does President Museveni acknowledge how much of a role he had in permitting this fighting to go forward?
Yeah, he does. He does, and sometimes in happier moments, he's able to brag about it. He knows that without his support, certainly RPF would not have made it, or even made it in the time that he was able to make it. I think Uganda's support, Museveni's support, was very, very critical, if not one of the most critical factors that was able to generate the energy for the RPF to do what it was able to do. Of course, people will tell you that there was a just cause, and even without Museveni, you know, things would have. Sometimes that's what Kagame and his military officers, especially during the period when the relationship between Uganda and Rwanda were not good, especially in the Congo after fighting in Congo. You know,
yes.
The Rwandan officers were saying, no. After all, we are the ones who helped put the Museveni in power. And what did he do for us? In any case, we would have done it by ourselves. But the reality is, I think Museveni's support and the fact that Uganda was a friendly country behind us, and that initially our soldiers, totaling almost 3,000, were able to cross into another country with all their weapons, and all the logistical support, and the fact that it was a friendly area, we could reorganize from Uganda and attack when it was necessary. So the fact was that even diplomatically and politically, that was a lot of support that Uganda, in the person of Museveni, gave to the RPF. And so Museveni once in a while brags about it. But sometimes when it was necessary, he would say, oh, these boys decided to go without my notice.
Yes.
But the fact is,
and the institutions failed everyone, right? The African Union didn't take it up. No one said you have to close that border. It was permitted like a forest fire to go on. I want to focus on what I want. And to me, you are addressing in your book, Healing a Nation, how to solve this, get Rwanda back to a stable country where people have rights and they don't live in fear, etc. And they were, I want to ask you, were they not on course to do that with the Arusha Accord? And wouldn't the Arusha Accord remain a good format or paradigm to go forward?
Absolutely. And that's why actually I devote more or less, I decided to cut and paste some of the essential elements of the Arusha Peace Agreement and put it within the book. Because remember, there is a whole young generation that was born after the Arusha peace process and after 1994 who may never have heard even about the Arusha peace process and the Arusha peace agreement. But in my opinion, the framework of the Arusha peace agreement is an enduring one, in that if you look at the protocol on the rule of law, you look at the question of what would happen to the national army, creation of a national army from the government army and the RPF army, to issues of power sharing, to issues of return of refugees. When you look at it, it's probably one of the most important things that could have come out of Rwandans sitting at the table and talking about how to address the problem of conflict and looking forward in a way that both Hutus and Tutsis and Twas, as the components of Rwandan society, could live together.
Yeah.
Now, it's precisely because I think that challenged the status quo that some people within Habyarimana's camp didn't like it. But it's also precisely because it provided a solution for the future that Kagame was very much against it and was willing to take the risk, the kind of risk that he took, killing President Habyarimana, that tripped the whole country into the crisis. So I still believe when we come to sit down and talk about the future of Rwanda, we shall have to revert back to some of these essential elements of the Arusha Peace Agreement.
Yeah. Now, I want to ask you about another matter that you take up. So, and people have to read this book. It is very thorough, very detailed. But there is a detail I want to clarify with you. And that is, we have the figure of Bill Clinton, and you discuss him at length in the book, and his associate Susan Rice, who is still president and now very powerful at the UN. And it says, the picture is, well, they stood by and did nothing. There was no, and this, and as you say, when you used to do the work, you represented people, you said, well, where were you? You didn't come and intervene. Now, which was that's a powerful argument, except that one detail is that Paul Kagame never asked for anybody to intervene, and he did threaten the Belgians. Who were UN. He said, you must leave, and he gave them a deadline.
No, we didn't. In fact, we did. I did describe in the book how we even were very active. I was very active internationally and on radios. We did send delegations to New York. I think the late colleague of ours, Claude Saidi, who was Canadian, actually he used to live in Canada, used to be our diplomatic representative to North America. And my own brother, Gerard Gahima, we sent them to New York. They met Madeleine Albright. They met many other people. In fact, we were discouraging the United Nations and the international community to intervene.
Discouraging.
And saying, I write it in the book, we used to say, oh, all the Tutsis are dead, so what are you coming to do?
Yes.
Now that all the Tutsis are dead, of course not all Tutsis were dead.
But even on the day, I mean, after all, you lost a comrade there, Seth Sendashonga.
Yeah.
Was in the CND, etc. They were not asking the UN to come and intervene.
It's very clear within the DRPF, really, we didn't want any intervention because we thought that any intervention was actually coming to freeze the situation and take away what we consider to be victory within reach.
Yes, exactly.
So that's why we didn't want any international intervention. So it's a kind of dishonest part on the part of DRPF because we were saying, oh, why didn't you intervene?
Yes.
But on the other hand, we actually didn't want anybody to intervene.
Well, I think that's a very important point. I'm so glad you talk about it. And it is, that's why people have to get this book. Frankly, it is like testimony from a highly qualified witness. And I want to ask you about this. There is a man in Arusha, Tanzania. He has been acquitted of any crimes. His name is Jerome Bichimba Mpaka. Mm-hmm. And he went to the United Nations on behalf of the Rwandan government and to ask them to intervene, but people tried to prevent him from doing that. And you know, now he's acquitted. It turns out he's not guilty of anything. But the effort by the government actually to bring you in, people don't know that government, such as it was saying, please come and intervene. But they weren't heard.
Yeah, that's the period. What RPF has been able to successfully do during and after 1994 is simply to turn the tables against the international community by saying, look, And it's true also that it is a remarkable failure on the part of the international community for either having stood by or simply abandoned the Rwandan people. All Rwandan people, not only abandoning Tutsis, but also abandoning the Hutus. Mm-hmm. And it has been able to say, oh, you abandoned the Rwandan people, so who are you to criticize us? And so it's been very, RPF has been very, very effective in doing that. But the fact of the matter is that the RPF only wanted, has always wanted an international community that is on its side. If the international community is not on its side or keeping silent in the face of what the international community has, RPF has committed also against the Rwandan people, then simply, if the international community questions, then the RPF throws a tantrum, Kagame throws a tantrum, and simply tries to shame the international community into into guilt.
Your testimony, of course, joins that of so many now. You almost, in a way, in terms of actual credible witnesses and people who know, you make a kind of interesting majority of people. I mean, there is Luc Machal, the former Belgian commander who was there. And you have, of course, General Yamwasa. If anybody really wants to know what happened, the evidence is there. And you are beginning to organize a movement. And I notice it's quite broad, and it includes, I want to get your opinion of, Victoire Ingabire, who is presently in a prison with her head shaved, wearing a pink costume because she wanted to run for president, right?
Yes. That's true. Ours is a broad coalition from within the Rwandan National Congress itself. It's a broad coalition in terms of partnership with others that includes the Victoire Ingabire's party. It also includes another party, Amahoro People's Congress, and we're slowly building a big coalition of opposition groups that will, of course, include civil society as well, because we believe the idea of coalition politics is not only important to help us build the strength to remove dictatorship within Rwanda, but you can only build a nation by building coalition amongst the constituents of society within Rwanda itself. So it's not only important for now, it's also important for tomorrow, because you can only build genuine reconciliation and genuine healing if you build on the energy of all the Rwandan people, the Hutus, Tutsis, and Tuas. Yeah. So that's a very important point to note.
Yeah, and finally, of course, your goal is to replace a system which is based actually on one organization with a military component called the RPF, right? In other words, it would have to be dismantled in order for Rwandan society to live and breathe.
For Rwanda to breathe and to have institutions that are representative, whether security institutions, or democratic institutions, or genuine justice that looks at justice for each one of us, for every Rwandan. If that has to happen, then RPF, as we know it, must cease to exist like that. Its monopoly hold on power must end, and its hold on monopoly on security institutions must end. The sham democracy that they talk about every day must end. And the biased so-called justice, which cannot be justice if it's biased, must end, because it has looked at the crimes committed by one community, forgetting the crimes committed by the other. And so RPF, as we know it, cannot sustain itself into the future we are talking about.
Yeah.
However, if we have a genuine dialogue with Kagame and the company and the RPF, they will have to accept the new conditions. If they don't accept the new conditions, then certainly RPF, like many others before it, will have to be swept aside by the tide of history.
That's a very nice summary. Dr. Theogen Rudasingwa, Healing a Nation, a Testimony. They say this on blurbs, but I mean it. I couldn't put it down. I thank you very, very much for being our guest.
Thank you. Thank you, Theo.
Okay. Bye-bye. And you've been listening to Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. And as you know, this subject is close to our hearts. And you can write to us, Taylor at CIUT.FM. Check us out, Taylor-report.com. And we'll see you next week.